This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back. And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Another horrific terrorist attack in France. We spoke about it on last week's program, but the conflict between the French and radical Islam continues to heat up. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yesterday, a man took about a foot-long knife into a church in the French city of Nice. He was shouting, Allahu Akbar, while he attacked people who had come to the church there. There was an older woman, I think she was in her 70s. They described her as being virtually decapitated. There was another person at the church who was killed. There was another woman who was repeatedly stabbed, who got away and then later died of her injuries. So just a horrible attack, and one that, we were talking about an attack this time last week that happened 2 weeks ago, and then you've got another brutal attack. This really has the attention of France and Europe and the world. The attacker was a Tunisian national. He'd been in France for about a month. He'd come into the EU via Italy back in September, probably as an illegal immigrant. And there have been a number of other much smaller attacks even this week as well. There was a man knifed a guard at the French consulate in Saudi Arabia, for example. So quite understandably, all across Europe, all across France, people have been condemning this attack. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has spoken out against it. Pope Francis has condemned an attack that sowed death in a place of prayer. Even some places like Turkey has condemned the attack and said that they stand with the person, or they stand with France. So an attack that has gained France's attention, Europe's attention, the Catholic Church's attention, and the world's attention.
Now, the fact that Turkey actually came out in support of France is a little bit of a change from the rhetoric that we were hearing from the French president before against Macron for some of the statements that he made that were against Muslims.
That's right. I think this has been one of the most surprising almost aspects of this story, as it's been developing over the last few weeks, is just how many Muslim countries and Muslim people have kind of lined up to condemn France. As we talked about last show, you had Emmanuel Macron kind of gave this Islam is in crisis speech a few weeks ago. And then there were further measures after that beheading that took place a couple of weeks ago. And so in response to that, the Muslim world has really been in an uproar, especially led by Erdogan. Erdogan has basically said that the way Muslims are being treated in France is the way Muslims are being treated in Europe is the way that Jews were being treated in Europe shortly before the Holocaust. He called Emmanuel Macron brain dead. He called on countries across the Middle East or Muslims to boycott French goods. And you saw some of that follow through well beyond Islam into Saudi Arabia and a lot of other Muslim countries. There were effigies of Emmanuel Macron being burned in Bangladesh. Boycott France became a trending hashtag. You had the Pakistani prime minister, he tweeted that Macron was creating further polarization and marginalization that inevitably leads to radicalization. And he said that Macron had chosen to deliberately provoke Muslims, including his own citizens, and encourage the display of blasphemous cartoons targeting Islam and the Holy Prophet. And then the former Malaysian prime minister, I think this was even a few hours after the attack yesterday. Everything else I've spoken about was before that attack. He tweeted that Muslims have a right to be angry and to kill millions of French people for the massacres of the past. So I think it's astonishing enough that even in the wake of the murder 2 weeks ago, you had Muslim leaders basically saying, well, he was right to do that and criticizing France. And then Turkey has said they stand with France after the latest attack, but to have even Malaysia and some of these other attacks continue, it's really an incredible situation.
Well, it does seem like there's no resolution to that. If you have people who, if you have an attack against a French citizen for speaking out on behalf of Western values of free speech, they're completely antithetical to one another. Here's a person who beheads a teacher for this and further attacks along those lines. The Muslims who see the French president respond actually say that he's the one to blame, even though it was a Muslim provocation that led to him making the statements that he did. There is no resolution for that. You're going to have greater conflict. And when you look at the prophecy that talks about a push from a radical Middle Eastern power and the response from Europe there in Daniel 11 and verse 40, you're essentially seeing this on a micro scale already.
Right. I mean, what is Emmanuel Macron going to do now when you've got an elderly lady all but beheaded just for the crime of going to church? No country is going to tolerate that. Right. We talked about how he had already introduced some tough measures and already gotten rid of a lot of Muslims. He's going to have to do more. The French people quite reasonably are going to demand more and are demanding more. So you can see how he's going to get stronger. And then you see how the Muslims are responding already. And I think there's already several million Muslims in France, a lot of which are radicalized. You can see how this could spin out of control very quickly. And like you mentioned, this is exactly what we've been saying right from the start. We've been talking about this critical prophecy in Daniel chapter 11 that talks about this coming clash between the king of the north and the king of the south. And you can go back to our King of the South booklet that talks about how the king of the south is radical Islam, as led by Iran. And so you've got this clash between radical Islam and Christian Europe. And we talked a bit last week about how this crisis is pushing Europe to be more Christian. And you can see more of that in the wake of this attack on a church where Emmanuel Macron is also putting France into lockdown, telling people that they can't go to church. That's getting more of a pushback than it did last time he went into lockdown. People are saying, well, no, after there's been an attack in a church, we can't back away from going to church. We've got to do more to go to church. Hmm. It doesn't matter about the lockdown. We'll see how that goes. But you can see this clash building, and that clash talks about it being triggered by a push from radical Islam. And like you said, you see exactly the same dynamic taking place already, and already really bringing about some radical changes in France. And then all of Europe there, as this kind of conflict or this divide between France and the Muslim world develops, they've all been lining up right behind France. It's probably been one of the best things for European unity to have happened in the last few months. It's got all of these different nations on the same page, because on this issue, Europe's united.
Well, we have a lot to write about. You're working on an article for this coming Trumpet edition, and we have still a couple of weeks before this is the articles for this next issue are due. It'll be interesting to see what all develops over these next couple of weeks. It certainly is heating up quickly, and it seems like, as you said, both sides are digging in their heels. So we'll keep our eyes on that and look forward to your article on that subject. In the meantime, we'll post the King of the South, the booklet link in the show notes for today's program. Thank you for that, Richard. Americans go to the polls next Tuesday to choose their next president, but the current president isn't sitting around. He's still getting things done. The White House just signed another landmark agreement with Israel. To learn about this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, there was actually two changes to United States policy vis-a-vis Israel in the past week. On Thursday, the United States State Department, led by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, decided that finally Americans born in Jerusalem will be able to have Jerusalem, Israel, written on their passports as their country of birth. Up to now, even though Jerusalem was declared the capital of Israel from Congress back in 1995, even through the Trump presidency, just Jerusalem sits there on your passport. This was something that went to the United States Supreme Court back in 2015. And the court then ruled that the Obama administration had the responsibility for foreign policy, and so they could trump any decision. So my two children, though American citizens, have just Jerusalem written on their passport, not Jerusalem, Israel. That has officially changed as of Thursday. Americans can now have Israel written on their passports. The other more significant change took place a day earlier when David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, and Benjamin Netanyahu went in the middle of the West Bank to one of the largest towns in the basically the guts of the West Bank, Ariel, where there is Ariel University. I think it's got about 16,000 people that go to this university. This is classified as a settlement, though, this town. And they were there to revise certain scientific and business and agricultural collaboration partnerships between the United States and Israel. The language of these deals is boring, but what it does is essentially changes U.S. policy of the past 40 years, which said that inside territories that Israel has occupied since 1967, that the United States government would withhold from funding any joint ventures. That has now changed. The United States has decided that in follow-up to what they decided earlier on in the year, which has become known as the Pompeo Doctrine, that the United States does not take a stand whether Israel's occupation of the West Bank is legal or illegal. They are going to just treat it as the status quo until some peace deal is arranged. But now they're coming forward and saying, we're acting in that interest, and we are not going to withhold funding from our United States organizations that are working in parallel with Israel inside those borders.
The strong cooperation between the United States and Israel, the strong support that the American administration is showing for Israel continues. This is a stark contrast with what you saw in the final weeks of the previous administration, and reverses what Barack Obama did in the last days of his time in office. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you remember that the United States, often at the United Nations Security Council, it vetoes negative anti-Israel United Nations resolutions. It has done that historically. And there was a resolution that was put forward by other countries, but turns out that the United States was behind, that actually came, they decided for it to abstain from the resolution, which basically said that Israel is definitely the occupying power inside any territory that it took since 1967, the Six-Day War. And the final part of that resolution, again, that the Obama administration orchestrated, said this, quote, "It calls upon all states to distinguish in their relevant dealings between the territory of the State of Israel and the territory occupied since 1967. So if you're a country and you want to do a deal with Israel, that deal of that company, of Israeli company, they better not have work done inside the West Bank, in the Golan Heights, because we deem that that is breaking international law to go ahead and deal with that Israeli company. The United States now has totally destroyed that resolution in the sense that now they see no geographic restriction on partnership with the State of Israel, a complete reversal of that Obama-era policy.
We have talked about this resurgence in the United States that is prophesied. Our editor-in-chief has pointed to this prophecy in 2 Kings several times, actually having an impact on Britain and Israel in particular, these other nations that it's linked with prophetically. Explain that.
Yes, this prophecy of a resurgence in Israel, the United States, led by President Donald Trump, Mr. Flurry talks about it being a fulfillment of a prophecy in the book of Kings, 2 Kings, which details the reign of Jeroboam II, who lived in the mid-8th century BCE. And this was a king that, though he wasn't close to God, though he didn't represent God, God was merciful on the northern tribes of Israel at the time and had a resurgence. And that benefited the southern kingdom of Judah as well, which the state of Israel today comprises the Jews, which made up that southern kingdom. And it's really interesting looking at that parallel account from anciently to today, is that you had a different king down in the southern kingdom of Judah. That was King Uzziah. And he also benefited from that partnership with the Jeroboam II, the type that is fulfilled today by Donald Trump. And so we see this restoration, or this prophetic restoration, I guess, of a partnership between, if I can call it this, the northern kingdom, the northern kingdom of Israel, led by the chief tribe of that today being Manasseh, or biblical Manasseh, which makes up the United States and United States. And there is a partnership that is going on, the strongest partnership we've seen ever of any United States presidency with the state of Israel, or the end time fulfillment, or the descendants of that southern kingdom of Judah. There's a close partnership back then, and there's a close partnership again today, and both nations are benefiting from it. There is an article that explains this historical significance of these ancient rulers and how it applies today. I definitely do recommend you read this. Otherwise, it might sound very confusing. But this article is entitled A Prophesied Resurgence in Israel. It's written by managing editor of thetrumpet.com, Mr. Brad McDonald. It's at our Watch Jerusalem website, and it goes into the history and also talking about the prophetic prophecy of this close relationship between the United States and Israel today.
All right. Thanks for that, Brent. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for today's program. The upper crust of China's Communist Party concluded a major meeting this week plotting out the next 5 years. There were definitely some important signals as to what we can expect from China in the time ahead. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the leader of China, Xi Jinping, and the Chinese Communist Party's highest decision-making body, the Central Committee, they just wrapped up, as you said, a very important four-day meeting. This was the fifth plenum of the CCP's 19th Central Committee. Just wrapped up yesterday, and they basically used this time to create a blueprint for China's next five-year plan, and even going beyond that time frame in some regards. And there is a lot to unpack from the plan hatched by these men, you know, some of the most powerful men in the world. And a lot of the post-plenum communique that they produced focuses on just how much progress China has made in recent years. It's very triumphalist in tone, but it tells the people of China that they need to be working even harder as they go forward to achieve sustained growth and what it calls significantly improved quality and efficiency during the next five-year period. And one notable detail is that in these calls for growth, there's no specific numeric target set for gross domestic product. So that's just a stark departure from the past, when China's kind of obsession with growth at all costs has always prompted party leaders to set those kinds of clear numeric goals. China is now apparently realizing how much book cooking and other kinds of corruption that has caused in China, and they're apparently now saying that they want quality more than just raw numbers that are often inflated and skewed by officials trying to meet these impossible targets. So that was notable. And there's also quite a lot of emphasis on boosting domestic consumption. So consumption inside of China. China is tired of being so heavily dependent on other nations buying its products, especially now that China's growing so aggressive and becoming just more of a black sheep in the eyes of many Westerners. So China doesn't want to be at the mercy of foreign buyers. It wants to enrich its own citizens, especially those in poor rural areas, enough so that Chinese people are buying more of China's products, and so that the country's economy is more self-sufficient. And then the plenum also focused quite a lot on making China more innovative, especially in ways that make its tech companies less dependent on America for advanced technologies. So they covered a lot of ground in that meeting, and it shows that China is working to become more economically independent, and that'll almost certainly accompany more aggression in foreign policy moves as well. So this will just give China a freer hand and less reason to abide by international laws and norms.
Now, in mapping out the next 5 years, ordinarily there would be a change in Chinese leadership during that time.
Yes.
But that was not discussed at this meeting.
Right. Really, I think that's the big headline here. That's the main takeaway, is that no one was designated to become the next paramount leader of China. You know, Xi Jinping came into power back in 2012, 2013, and precedent would require him to step down as head of the Chinese Communist Party in 2022. You know, there's been a 10-year limit in place for Chinese leaders. That would have meant that the meeting this week would have basically continued preparing the party and the nation for that leadership transition. But as you said, no heir apparent has been named. And this wasn't a big surprise at this point, since Xi Jinping has been telegraphing for quite a few years now his intention to stay in power indefinitely. But this meeting did just confirm that we're living in a new era with China, and we should expect Xi to be in power for a long time, basically as long as his health or other global circumstances permit. And I think it might be easy to view Xi Jinping's rise as just an ambitious man who has kind of maneuvered to make himself this untouchable authoritarian. But really, his rapid ascent could not have happened had it not been for the assistance and the full consent of that upper crust of the Chinese Communist Party. These Chinese elite, they see that the global order is unraveling. They see American power declining. They see leadership vacuums opening up. And I believe they see that the international stage is set for conflict, and that there's a big opportunity for China to take advantage of all that. So I think they wanted a ruler whose hands were not bound by red tape. They wanted a strong man who is free of, you know, political encumbrances, and who's able to just streamline all the decision making. They wanted essentially a new Chairman Mao, and now they have one. They have Chairman Xi, and we know that Xi is incredibly nationalistic, even jingoistic, far more than his recent predecessors have been. So to see him becoming Chairman Xi, Emperor for life, that's it's just a chilling development.
Where would you send people to study about the prophetic ramifications of this strongman development in China?
We actually devoted an entire issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet to the trend of the rise of strongmen like Xi Jinping. And our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, wrote the lead article in that issue. It's called The New Strongman Age. And part of his article says, for nearly two centuries, the dominant geopolitical trend in the world was the spread of democratic free societies. But this century will be totally different. The dominant trend thus far has been the rise of authoritarian strongmen. We thought we were too modern for this, yet here it is. And then skipping down a little bit, he starts to talk about the fact that this was prophesied in the Bible. He goes into passages in the books of Daniel and Revelation and Matthew. He also spends some time in Ezekiel, which really zeroes in specifically on China and the role that it will play working with Russia, with both nations ruled by strongmen. So that was foretold by Ezekiel some 2,500 years ago, and now we see this happening. So I think that article by Mr. Stephen Fleury would be a great place for people to go just to understand really what's behind this trend.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. That five-year plan looked at China's future, but some of China's recent past activities are being exposed in the American political scene these days. Revelations that it has actively worked to buy off U.S. tech companies, media elites, and politicians at the highest level. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
That is really key to understanding the radical left's assault on the Trump administration for since the beginning of his office. We've had new revelations come out just this week by a former Navy veteran, Tony Bobulinski. He sat down with Tucker Carlson at Fox News for an hour this week and just went over detail after detail of a business venture between Joe Biden, his son Hunter Biden, his brother Jim Biden, and a Chinese energy company. And he pointed out in this detail that in some of these emails and this infamous laptop they got from Hunter Biden, this joint venture they talked about with this Chinese energy company says that, well, they really should be giving 10% of their profits to the big guy, who Tony Bobulinski reaffirmed that the big guy was Joe Biden. Hunter Biden not having any experience in the energy industry. They're saying that the reason this Chinese company was interested in his investment firm in the first place not was because of anything that Hunter Biden could bring to the table, but because of the political connections he brought with the Biden family. And Tony Bobulinski, in addition to this interview, he's also had a huge trove of documents backing up what he says that he's turned over to the U.S. Senate, and the Senate's verified this week that everything they've received from him so far is verified. And so this is really the first concrete tie to Joe Biden himself. A lot of the past revelations from this laptop have been about Hunter Biden and then bringing his father into it by extension. But this is the first concrete example of Joe Biden receiving part of these profits. And there's obviously a lot you can say about the national security implications for just corruption in political circles this high. But you can also take a bigger picture and bringing it back to the point you made at the beginning about China's just entanglement with U.S. media, political, and industrial elites.
Mm-hmm. And Bobulinski specifically said that Joe Biden, based on what he knows, Joe Biden is compromised.
Right. Yeah. Bobulinski was definitely, that's mainly the point he focused on, is the compromising of Joe Biden. He's beholden to the Communist Party of China. And then the Communist Party of China could use that as blackmail against him. Another analyst that was talking about these types of stories, even before the Hunter Biden laptop was revealed, was Lee Smith at the Tablet. And he's talked more broadly about just Chinese entanglement with the tech industry, with Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't that long ago we were talking about these Chinese Communist Party members who were being hired at Facebook.
Right. Yeah, that was actually a Project Veritas actually released document showing that Facebook actually has a policy where they want to favor Chinese nationals over Americans they could be hiring. And so you see that when Facebook starts doing Chinese-style censorship, that's because they've got some of the same people working on their teams. But Lee Smith's point here was that, especially in American industry, by offshoring so many jobs to China, I mean, a lot of these companies, like multinational companies, have become very rich because they're producing goods at a fraction of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
Of what you could produce them if you were paying someone in the United States minimum wage. He has a comment from one of his recent articles saying that America's political and corporate elites didn't choose the decline. They didn't choose to watch their nation decline. They chose to get rich. By shipping America's manufacturing base off to China, they seized a business opportunity the likes which has never been seen before. An enormous captive workforce controlled by an authoritarian regime that guarantees the steady productions of goods at a fraction of the cost of what would be at home. And then a little further on, he says, America's financial elite with China is the key to understanding what's been happening in America for the past 4 years. Any president, Democrat or Republican, who took on China would have been targeted by the China class. Because it was Trump flying the Republican banner who sided with Americans' working men and women, the Democrats resorted to alliances with powers that now threaten the stability and security of the country.
Hmm.
Basically making the point that when Trump was campaigning in 2016, that was kind of his two signature campaign promises, is get illegal immigration under control and bring America's jobs back from China. Now, if you're a politician or a Silicon Valley media mogul or the leader of a multinational conglomeration that ships jobs off with China, bringing America's jobs back from China is going to be horrible for your bottom line. It might help American, like, blue-collar people who want their jobs back. That's a really big reason of why what Lee Smith calls the China class is attacking President Trump. President Trump standing up against unfair trade practices from China, trying to bring jobs back for working-class Americans and for these political, industrial, media elite. That is going to hurt their bottom line, because so many of them, they're reliant on what basically amounts to slave labor in a communist country.
There's a really big story here to think about the kind of power that some of these elites in media, in technology, in politics have, and the benefits that they're gaining personally from some of these decisions, and the amount that this is harming America's national interests is really quite extraordinary. It makes me think of prophecies where it talks about America or Israel actually giving its power to its enemies and really undercutting its own interests in ways that are bringing the nation down.
Right, right. You've got this political elite that they are putting their own profit above the interest of not just the American people, but an American national security, and especially like industries like rare earth minerals or steel and aluminum, where China's trying to establish monopolies on materials that we need for military and industrial applications. That's a huge risk for the country. But also, our editor-in-chief made a really interesting point in an article he did, it's been a few months ago now, titled "Where is the America-China Clash Leading?" Basically making the point that something like Trump's war against this China class was really necessary to fulfill prophecy, because he points to a verse in Deuteronomy verses 52 that talks about the descendants of Abraham, or the United States and Britain today, being economically besieged by their enemies, besieged in all their gates. And then there's other prophecies like in Isaiah that talk about Kittim and Tarshish, Asian powers that are part of this besiegement. So really, to see China like start using sea gates around the world to impose like trade embargoes on the United States infers that you do need to see some level of decoupling between the American and the Chinese economy. Right now, the Chinese industrial elites and the American industrial elites are so intertwined that all political analysts are saying that like you couldn't have a massive trade embargoes between the two countries, because it would hurt the other partner just as much as it hurts you. So there's got to be some level of decoupling happen before China can really throw its full weight as a hostile enemy behind the nation, America, that currently is its main customer. That transition from customer to enemy is going to involve an escalating trade war that starts seeing America doing less and less business with China, which and you can graph out. I mean, some of it's due to the COVID-19 epidemic, but a lot's due to President Trump's efforts that, I mean, trade between America and China is falling right now. It's actually falling fairly substantially. I haven't broken it down to see how much of it is like trade from us going to them and trade from them going to us, but the total trade volume is coming down, and that's a trend you'd expect to intensify in the lead up to seeing China rise up as a hostile, overtly hostile enemy to the United States.
Where is the China-America clash leading? Is the article from Gerald Fleury that we'll link to in the show notes, and I'd like to learn more about this. I hope you'll write something up about this in the time ahead. Thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, a couple of stories about nuclear weapons development, one from Iran, the other from Japan. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
After one of its nuclear facilities was attacked this past summer, Iran has gone back to work building new, more secure nuclear plants, according to the UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, this week the United Nations Atomic Energy Agency confirmed that Iran has begun work in constructing a new nuclear facility close to the Natanz facility, the one that you mentioned that was blown up most likely by, or at least caused to be destroyed by Israelis back in June. This is very close. Well, the construction of this new one is in the hills of Natanz. The plan is for it to be underground, heavily underground, so that it cannot be targeted by Israel in terms of an aerial attack of something of that nature. And as well as the IAEA's Director General coming out and confirming that they were doing this, there was satellite imagery that was released on Wednesday to confirm that earth-moving work has begun also. So this is significant because Israel really did decide, if it was Israel, looks like it was Israel, that they were at a point with Iran's nuclear weapons program that they had to destroy the Natanz facility. This is a place where they assemble the centrifuges that would then, once the centrifuges are made, go deep underground where it's impossible for Israel to actually target, and that's where they would spin and produce the weapons grade or the more enriched uranium. And so what's happened over the past couple of months, I mean, the AP came out and confirmed this through the IAEA, but Iran already said back in September 13th, that they were going to do exactly this. Yes, our Natanz facility was partly destroyed. Yes, we are now going to start building in the middle of a mountain to stop it from being able to be destroyed again through that same manner. So it's not surprising that Iran is doing this. It will make it far more difficult in the future to try and stop Iran from getting the weapons-grade uranium necessary to put on a nuclear warhead.
The idea of Iran building a nuclear facility that is beyond the reach of other nations to shut down, that's pretty terrifying.
Yeah, and that's the point of this, obviously. They have been very, very smart with the way that they've constructed their nuclear infrastructure, spreading it all across the country. And now they're very open with the fact that they intend to develop very sophisticated, fast centrifuges that can make their pathway to the bomb. I was very surprised, actually, by the AP report, because it kind of played this down, the significance of this. This is the second paragraph of the AP report that everyone quoted throughout the world. Iran also continues to stockpile greater amounts of low-enriched uranium, but does not appear to possess enough to produce a weapon, Rafael Grossi, the director general of the IAEA, told us. So they're saying that they're going to construct more centrifuges in this new location that can't be targeted by a weapon. And the IAEA says that, well, they've got stockpiles of greater enriched uranium, but they don't appear to produce enough for a nuclear weapon. Now, further on down in the article, that comment is clarified by Grossi. This is what he said, actually, quoting him now. It says this, the article continues further down. The IAEA's current assessment is, however, that Iran does not at the moment possess a significant quantity of uranium defined by the agency as enough to produce a bomb. Quote, at the moment, I'm not in contact with my inspectors, but by memory, I wouldn't say so. So it seems like we're a little bit cavalier here with our approach to the amount of enriched uranium they have, to the point that, well, I can't really remember off the top of my head, but I don't think so. That's the head of the IAEA. I'm sure he has greater information to his hand at that. But it just, that type of thinking with Iran's nuclear weapons program, I think, exists all across the world and probably in our own minds as well. We've been talking about this for 20 years, Iran's nuclear weapons program, and they haven't had a bomb yet. But right now, they are 3 months away from having, if they choose to, the amount of enriched uranium that would be necessary to have a bomb. So that's where we're at. They are moving forward towards the bomb. They're getting to the point that it cannot be targeted by foreign weaponry unless there's some type of spies in there or doing something internally inside Iran. And so we are moving forward towards a nuclear armed Iran. That is Iran's goal. They've said it. And that's what we're moving towards. So don't get lulled to sleep by this. Certainly Israelis are going to be more worried that they won't be able to target this site. Perhaps they'll try and do something before that. But we've talked about how Iran does have a quest for a nuclear weapon. They want it. People believe, and even in Israel today, many people believe that they wouldn't use it because they'd be scared of the retribution from Israel or anywhere else in the world. But we have stated, and Iranians have stated, the Ayatollah have stated, that he was going to let his nation burn if it meant that Islam could be spread across the region. So anyone that thinks that Iran is a safe player, a safe international player to have nuclear weapons, it's not true. We should be concerned about this. We should continue to watch Iran's nuclear weapons program. Biblical prophecy says they are going to get abilities to use these weapons.
Thank you for that, Brent. We will link to an article that we have, Can Israel Prevent Iran from Using a Nuclear Weapon, in the show notes for more prophetic context there. As Iran builds its nuclear facility, Japan is stockpiling plutonium at rates that far exceed what would make sense if it's just for energy purposes. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, the Japanese government has said that it's moving forward with a controversial nuclear energy policy that basically relies on extracting plutonium from spent nuclear fuel and then reusing that material in special nuclear reactors. So Japan's been saying for years that it wants to make this nuclear reprocessing plan work, but critics recognize that it's just fully illogical for at least three reasons. First, it's economically unsound. This program was supposed to have been operational starting back in 1997, but technological setbacks have caused delay after delay. They've actually had 24 major delays now. And so the program's budget is just shattered. It's bankrupt beyond redemption. So that's one big problem. The second one is that Japan has very dim prospects for actually using plutonium extracted from used fuel for energy. This type of material has to be burned in a special kind of nuclear reactor, and Japan tried to build one of those starting in the early 2000s, but they pulled the plug on it in 2016. Then they tried to work with France to build another one, but the French government ended up pulling the plug on that one. At this point, they have no plans even in place to build one of these special reactors. So it's unlikely that Japan could ever even use this material for fuel. And then the third big strike against it is just the optics. You know, as part of this plan, the country already has, as you said, a stockpile of 46 tons of plutonium. That's enough to make 6,000 atomic bombs. It means Japan has more plutonium than is in the nuclear weapons of China, France, India, Israel, North Korea, Pakistan, and the UK combined.
Wow.
And now they want to extract more that they don't even have a viable plan in place to actually use as energy. So it's a very bad look for Japan. Countries think that they're not being transparent about their true intentions.
And what are Japan's intentions based on what we know and what Bible prophecy tells us?
Yeah, well, I think if you put all this together, you have to say that even though Japan, you know, the government insists that they have no military plans in mind for this, I can't think of another purpose for why they would be refusing to get rid of these massive stockpiles. And the fact is that even though plutonium is reactor grade, it's entirely capable of producing nuclear weapons. And there are quite a few analysts who believe that that is what Japan is up to here, that even if they don't have a plan fully in place, that they are leaving the door open to such a plan so that in an emergency they could quickly kind of flip the switch and turn all of this into a very large nuclear weapons arsenal. And when we consider Japan's wartime history and just how disturbingly fanatic its troops are prone to becoming when they're intent on conquest, then I think that this should be getting a lot more attention in headlines. And then Japan's march back toward militarism is also significant. because it's setting the stage for some specific Bible prophecies to be fulfilled. Scripture shows that in the final world war, one of the primary powers will be a huge Asian confederation. The Bible shows that it'll be led by Russia, but there are also names given showing that Japan will be a part of that. So Japan's militarization today, including all of the plutonium that it's stockpiling, is setting the stage for that prophesied Asian force to be just a truly devastating block. So if anyone would like to understand more about that in the prophetic context, we have an article called Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism that really sets it out.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremiah. Germany is in a quandary leadership-wise. Who will replace Angela Merkel? Her time in office will be up next year, but her successor remains a mystery. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Germany is really in unprecedentedly leaderless times at the moment. Angela Merkel announced that she would be stepping down all the way back in 2018. And since then, Germany still hasn't been able really to figure out a replacement. I remember when she was stepping down, the next election kind of seemed ages away. Now the next election is around the corner, you know, less than a year away, like you were saying, and we don't know who the next German leader was going to be. Now, Germany was going to be selecting their next leader on December 4th. That was when they had plans to have another party convention. They cancelled that this week due to coronavirus. And so, but they haven't announced how they're going to pick a leader, what's going to replace it, anything like that. So getting close to election time period, Angela Merkel has already said she won't run, but nobody really knows who will.
So at this point, who are the contenders for that office?
So we're looking at a pretty divided field. Ms. Merkel, she'd initially selected Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer to succeed her. She was chosen in December 2018. She kind of quit her position earlier this year because she'd become very unpopular. At the moment, the race looks like basically between Armin Laschet, who's the state premier of Nordrhein-Westphalia, and he basically is the continuation candidate, the one that would be most like Angela Merkel. However, he was the least popular. The favorite to win was Friedrich Merz, who is kind of... He's running as an outsider, as an anti-Merkel. He kind of quit politics in disgust back when he was beaten by Ms. Merkel for the chancellorship about a decade ago. And he's much more right-wing, much more about tacking to the right, and even a bit more like the alternative for Deutschland. And he is causing trouble now. He is accusing this cancellation of being politically motivated, that basically Ms. Merkel and the rest of the party hierarchy saw that he was winning and cancelled the selection to make sure that they're to try and give their preferred candidate a chance to catch up. There's one more important person to watch, though, and that is the Bavarian state premier Markus Söder. He is the leader of Angela Merkel's sister party, the CSU, but the leader of the sister party could be the chancellor candidate next election round. And he is actually in the lead at the polls right now as the most popular candidate in the field to be the next leader.
The Trumpet has been watching the political scene in Germany for a long time because of really, really strong prophecies of what is going to happen there. Tell us how this may lead to the fulfillment of those prophecies.
Yes, one of the key forecasts that we've been watching right from the earliest days of the Trumpet is that there would be a strong leader come to power in Germany. There's a lot of scriptures that talk about this, and they even talk about how he will come to power. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 21, for example, talks about this person, and it says that he will come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And this word, this same passage talks about him having a fierce countenance and understanding of dark sentences. And Clark's commentary talks about this being very learned and skillful in all things relating to government and intrigue. This word flatteries even refers to coming in a kind of a sneaky way. The JFB commentary says the nation shall not by a public act confer the kingdom on him, but he shall obtain it by artifice, by flatteries. You know, he doesn't come into power in the usual way. So we've been watching for this, and now you've got Germany where with no clear leader and a whole lot of division, no real standouts that the Germans are really enthusiastic about. And so you've got a fantastic opportunity for that prophecy to be fulfilled. At the start of 2019, Mr. Flurry wrote, "Current conditions in Europe, including the refugee crisis and the turmoil in German politics, provide probably one of the greatest opportunities ever for a new leader to come into power by flatteries. Chancellor Merkel is on her way out and now a lame duck. Expect political and social crises in Germany and Europe and public resentment and anger to grow even deeper. Then watch for a strong man to take advantage and make his way to power through flatteries." And the whole coronavirus crisis has kept this perfect condition for a leader to come to power by flatteries going for quite a long time. And that window is just going to continue. And we have a free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. And that will explain, show you why these prophecies, why Daniel 11 is talking about a modern German leader, and help prove to you what the Bible is saying here, because this is a crucial step to watch for in biblical end time events.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard. We'll finish in America. Yet another police shooting that sparked mass looting, arson, and violence, this time in the city of Philadelphia. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this police shooting occurred on Monday when a 27-year-old black man was in the process of being arrested by police officers. He had a knife as a weapon, trying to fend off the police. He was told repeatedly to put it down, but then allegedly charged the officers with the knife and was shot multiple times in the ensuing conflict. This, as so many police shootings have done this year, provoked rioting in Philadelphia that's been occurring since Monday. And there's been really widespread. It seems like this one, more than other riots, I've heard reports of them people looting ATMs, which is probably your best indication that the rioters don't necessarily have justice for Walter Wallace Jr. At heart. Like, nothing says justice like taking a homemade bomb, blowing up an ATM, and taking all the money inside. This especially coming up right with the elections makes this a significant riot. Actually, both presidential candidates have come out and condemned the looting, which is pretty normal for President Trump to condemn looting. That's a bigger step for Joe Biden to actually come out and speak against the rioting. Although the solutions the two have put forward are very different, with President Trump offering to send federal troops if needed, and Joe Biden just saying that once if he's elected, he'll establish a commission to brainstorm ideas on how we can stop things like this from continually happening over and over again. But we'll put an article we've put in the show notes several times this year already, from our editor-in-chief, entitled "Race Riots Were Prophesied," that goes through prophecies in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 7 especially, talking about cities burning with fire because of violence from the strangers or non-Israelites therein. There's definitely a lot of burning in Philadelphia this week as one of just the repeated fulfillments of that prophecy we've seen so far this year.
All right. Thank you very much, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Epictetus: "Nothing great is created suddenly, any more than a bunch of grapes or a fig. If you tell me you desire a fig, I answer you that there must be time. Let it first blossom, then bear fruit, then ripen." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world. We'll be right back.
been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.